And the report today, I'm going to work with David Jackson, who is at the University of Waterloo in the Department of Combinatorics and Optimization. And he asked me to convey the message that he is happy to share his expertise in combinatorics and optimization with anybody here at PI and whoever's at the conference as well. He'd like to get involved more in mathematical physics. Alejandro Morales, who is now at MIT, was a student of ours. I will talk today on graph theory in quantum field theory. And as such, this topic is not really in the mainstream of this conference. It will have to do a little bit with quantum information. It has to do with quantum theory for sure, but quantum field theory. And a lot with graphs, but Feynman graphs. So it's not quite the mainstream of this conference, but I hope you find it interesting anyway. I was asked to at least start out, or about half of the talk, to have it introductory and pedagogical. So here's an overview. First, what is quantum field theory anyway? Quantum field theory is a generalization of quantum mechanics. It's the generalization that accounts for relativity, and that accounts for particle creation and particle annihilation processes. It is a fully established theory. It's more than half a century old, and it is the theory of physics. Only gravity doesn't quite completely fit into it yet. But we are working on it right here. So it explains everything from, you know, cosmology, high energy physics, to chemistry, and it explains why the sky is blue. Now, quantum information is quantum information theory was initially started within the framework of non-relativistic quantum mechanics and is now being generalized to relativistic theory as well. And ultimately, of course, we want to generalize all of quantum information theory to quantum field theory, which is the real thing. But more than being of importance for quantum information in the sense of building a quantum computer or quantum communication, generalizing quantum information theory to quantum field theory should also be useful for this last little bit that we don't understand in physics, quantum gravity. You know, in things like the Hawking effect and other effects like that, we have come to think that quantum information is going to play a crucial role in understanding what's going on. On the other hand, graphs will also come in, and plenty of them. Not that I will draw them a lot, because I don't really know how to do it in PowerPoint. And that's because the main method for solving problems in quantum field theory is using Feynman graphs. I will talk about some new results, in particular about a proof that reproves a key theorem of Feynman graphs. You may wonder why on earth would we want to reprove something that's known already. Well, we are actually generalizing something there in this proof, and we're putting it on a more solid footing as well. And we will gain some new insights about what the path integral means, what the path integral means in general, that is for quantum field theory. And we will see that there is a beautiful and rather unexpected duality of Feynman graphs and Feynman rules that I don't know how far it carries within graph theory, and I don't know what the significance of it is in physics. It's quite recent that we realized that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so quantum field theory. Just for those of you who may have a computer science background or so, may not be familiar with this, let me quickly go through the basics here. There exist a dozen or so of species of fundamental particles in nature. And examples are electrons, quarks, photons, neutrinos, Z particles, W particles, and so on. And as we know from quantum mechanics, each one of them we should describe to have a wave function, which you might call phi of x, q of x, a of x. When I write of x, I really mean of x and t. Okay, so this x always stands for position and time. Now, I'm going to neglect issues to do with fermionic degrees of freedom and gauge degrees of freedom, and the gauge theory. In quantum field theory, we don't speak of wave functions, however, we speak of fields. Now, what's the interpretation of those fields? Roughly speaking, very roughly, I'm glancing over a lot of interesting things here. Roughly speaking, large field amplitudes still mean a large probability to find a particle. But it's very, very rough. In the non-relativistic limit, that's actually a doable interpretation, but in the case of relativity, antiparticles come in and they spoil that interpretation. It's not that easy. But roughly, keep in mind, large fields means particles, lots of them, if the fields are large. But those fields are not normalized in quantum field theory, unlike wave functions in quantum mechanics. So in particular, while in quantum mechanics, if you have a wave function that's normalized, you describe one particle. That's basically what the one means in the normalization of the wave function. But here in quantum field theory, they're not normalized. You can describe many particles, as many as you like, with one field. So there's really only one field for one species of particle. You don't need five fields for five particles, as you would in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. One field describes all particles of that species. And more than that, the norm of such a field can change, which, roughly speaking, translates into the possibility to describe particle creation and particle annihilation processes as we see them in nature, something that couldn't be described by ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Now, you may wonder, what about those wave functions here? What about those fields? They are not normalized. They change their norm. What sort of rules govern them? If none of that still holds true. And after all, those you can think in some rough sense as being generalizations of wave functions. We hold it a sacred property of wave functions. They're normalized and they keep their norm and so on. Well, what is the dynamics of those fields in quantum field theory? No dynamics. Those fields don't obey any equations of motion. Instead, they virtually evolve through all possible evolutions. So all field evolutions are possible. It's just like in non-relativistic quantum mechanics in the particle picture where you say that a particle is no longer traveling on a trajectory. It is, as one would say in classical mechanics, it is pursuing all trajectories virtually. And so it is with the fields now in quantum field theory. Those fields, generalizations of the Schrödinger field, for example, don't obey the Schrödinger equation. They just do all evolutions with a certain probability amplitude. That's the principle of second quantization. That's how quantum field theory started. So what is the probability amplitude for a certain field evolution? So a field as a function of space and time. The probability amplitude for a particular field evolution, and I write down all the fields that we might have in nature, is given by up to a normalization constant n, this phase here, e to the power of I times the action. Action, you know, the action functional of the theory. The action functional is some scalar, it's some number that depends on the fields that you plug in, the field evolutions that you plug in. When I speak of a field, I mean a field as a function of space. A field evolution is a function of space and time. So the action is something where you plug in field evolutions phi, q, and a, and then you get out a number, a scalar. So you multiply those fields, differentiate them, integrate them, at the end you get a scalar. And we assume it to be a polynomial in those fields, phi, q, a, and so on. So if that's the probability amplitude, then we need to normalize to get the to get any prediction. And so that's the normalization factor here. The normalization factor is, of course, 1 over the sum of all the probability amplitudes that can occur for all configurations, for all field evolutions. So that is formally the sum of all probabilities, that is all probability amplitudes, for all field evolutions phi, field evolutions q, field evolutions a. But since those fields can vary continuously, I mean, you have one field and you have a field that's just infinitesimally different, we have to think of this as an integral, the so-called path integral. And you can imagine that this path integral is hard to define. In fact, some would claim impossible to define. But for now, let's just keep these things formal and work with it as if it were well defined. Later on, it's going to be a key issue at the end of the talk that we would like to make this thing really well defined. In fact, by getting rid of this analytic looking definition of a path integral altogether and define the whole thing in terms of graphs. A formal stationary phase analysis shows that the most likely field evolutions are those whose action is near to the extremal action. Just the usual stationary phase analysis, except that we now apply it in a function space rather than for just regular numbers. This means that in the limiting case, we have that those fields are most likely to evolve according to the Schrödinger, or let's say the Birac equation or Klein-Gordon equation, the usual first quantization evolutions, except that there are going to be quantum fluctuations around it because it's not strictly enforced. The extremal action path, the extremal action evolution is not strictly enforced, it's just the most likely one.
The classical evolution, what would you say, sure?
Yeah, well, I have the classical evolution of the fields, but the fields, of course, are themselves first quantized. Klein-Gordon fields, for example.
Yeah, but there are classical evolution of the field that contemplates creation of particles. So in that case, you would have a classical in the classical field theory, but cannot correspond in the Schrödinger, like in a first quantization Schrödinger.
No? We will get to that. We will get to the fact that an expansion in the potential is an expansion, is a derivative expansion, in number of loops in the final graph, and the expansion in OK, so this is called the fast integral, this thing, and we don't have to worry about it. So key predictions can now be made. In fact, all predictions can be made. Because if we can assign a probability amplitude for any field evolution, then we can calculate all expectation values we may ever be interested in. In particular, correlation functions. Correlation functions are of interest because they are related to entanglement. So a key prediction is that of correlation function. So for example, let us look at the correlation of field amplitudes at two points, x and x prime in space-time. So we look at the field at the point in space-time x, and the field at the point in at the point x prime in space-time, we multiply the two. So this is the product of two field amplitudes. We know that they are fluctuating because the fields are not deterministically evolving. It just do all evolutions with probability amplitudes. So let's calculate what this product is, the expectation value of that product. For that purpose, we take this product of the two field amplitudes, multiply with the probability amplitude, this thing, multiply with the probability amplitude for a particular product to occur. You see, we plug this phi into the action, it gives us the probability amplitude. And then we sum over, we pass integrate over all possible field evolutions phi that can occur. That gives us the expectation value for this product of fields. That's the correlation function for the two-point correlation function for field amplitudes. So if the field is having an elevated amplitude here, we can ask, how is that correlated with the field having a correlated amplitude over there? That's giving us the answer for that. And keep in mind that elevated field amplitudes mean, roughly speaking, that we are likely to find particles there. So from calculating this two-point function, we should be able, and in fact we are able, to calculate the propagation of particles. this is why this is also called the propagator. More generally, we can look at endpoint correlation function. So we can write down, for example, the correlator between two phi fields at positions x and x prime, positions in space-time, and another field q at the position x double prime. Again, we take the product of those fields, multiply with the probability amplitude for these products to occur, and sum over all possible field evolutions. This gives us the expectation value, a three-point function in this case. Three-point functions, or generally endpoint functions, describe not only the propagation of particles or of field disturbances, but they also describe the interaction of particles.
Yes.
So in this case, for example, that could be a phi particle propagating from x to x prime, and in the process emitting a q particle, or absorbing a q particle, depending on what the timeline is for x, x prime, x double prime. Now there are issues that come up immediately that have to do with entanglement and quantum information. Namely, it starts with an observation that was made in particular by Feynman. he showed that endpoint functions are generally non-zero almost everywhere, even in the vacuum, and even when the events x, x prime, and x double prime, where we calculate the field amplitudes, are chosen to be at equal time. You see, this is now surprising. You take a field in vacuum, so you're not preparing any particles in this. You just have the fields fluctuating on their own. You look at the field amplitude here, look at the field amplitude there, at equal time. Why would they be correlated? The correlation cannot be due to propagation, because they're space-like separated, the two events, and also not due to interaction. So the correlation is actually due to an entanglement of the vacuum state. More generally, you can think of those points, x, x prime, x double prime, and so on, as being expanded to finite size regions in space. So here you have a chunk of space, another chunk of space, another chunk of space. You have degrees of freedom in each one of those chunks. The field can fluctuate, can do all sorts of things. So you have a system here. There's a system of quantum field theory for this chunk of space, another system and that chunk of space, another system and that chunk of space. The total system in its ground state is entangled. So the vacuum state for subsystems that are just regions of space are entangled, and that is what is described by these endpoint functions. Endpoint functions are just a special case where you shrink those regions to points. But it's also true if you make them finite size, which is of course much more realistic to consider.
Literature or book about this quotation.
Feynman gave a lecture at Cambridge in 1986, the Dirac Memorial Lecture, which was printed as a little booklet. It's the first half of that, the Dirac Memorial Lecture. The second half is the article by Wadley. It's a little booklet. It's called Dirac Memorial Lecture, authors Feynman and Weinberg, and the title of Feynman's talk is The Reason for Anything.
Which year?
Can't tell you the page number.
Are these equal time correlations dropping off quickly with distance? Are they exponentially suppressed?
It depends. If the particles are massless, then actually only polynomial is suppressed.
And if they are massive, if they are massive, the mass gets the length scale for the exponential drop.
Yeah. Now you may think, well, okay, the vacuum is entangled. What is that going to be irrelevant for? The thing is that actually, the entanglement of the vacuum is a very important issue that has connections to the Ullmann effect and to the Hawking effect, and also what is called holography. But it also, it is related, or it's actually a central idea, a central feature of one of the greatest scientific ideas of the past half century, namely cosmic inflation. Those of you who may not be familiar with this, the idea of cosmic inflation is that the origin of all inhomogeneities, the origin, therefore, of all structure in the universe, the origin of all information in the universe, is thought to come, to have come from quantum fluctuations of the field, the so-called inflaton field. And the statistics of the inflaton field at that snapshot, where it was imprinted into the structure of space-time, very early on in the evolution of the universe, the statistics of those quantum fluctuations of that field that would have generated all the inhomogeneities in the universe is the statistics of equal time correlation functions, equal time endpoint functions. and this is, by the way, a rendering of the cosmic microwave background that gives us an early snapshot of the inhomogeneities in the universe. It's just projected onto a sphere. Really, we see this if we look out there this way. And those fluctuations you can, of course, analyze. You can look at the two-point correlation function, three-point correlation function, four-point correlation function of this. So the idea then is that really the statistics of the inhomogeneities in the universe goes back to the entanglement of the ring. The predictions are non-trivial and have been made for the first time about 25 years ago, and in the meanwhile, they have been measured with a very high precision with a satellite and balloon-based experiments, and more experiments are on the way. So far, it's beautifully confirmed. So how do we calculate those endpoint functions? In general, it's a rather complicated business, and I will get to this. But let me start out with a very simple case, just to get us started here. You see, the full case will require those Feynman graphs. But let's first look at the special case where the action, S, is an even polynomial in the field. Okay, so you might have a kinetic term in the field, that is quadratic. And then you might have a potential such as a fourth power, or it might interact with other fields, but only in even powers. If the action is an even polynomial in a field, as is the case in cosmic inflation for the inflaton field, so there is a very important example for that, then all odd n-partite vacuum entanglement vanishes. That's easy to see because if you look at, for example, the three-point function, well, it has the product of three fields, three-point function of three times the same field, okay, same species of field. It has the product of those three fields. That's an odd polynomial. If this thing is even in phi, then the integral, well, has no other chance. It has to vanish. So on very basic grounds, we don't really have to evaluate this path integral. We don't have to reduce this to a Riemann integral or something like that, or the Beck, which wouldn't work anyway. We don't have to worry about this. On general grounds, it has to just be zero. This is a firm prediction of of cosmic inflation, namely that its fluctuations are what is called Gaussian. And that is something that can be checked in the cosmic microwave background by calculating endpoint function. And there's some evidence that it might be violated, but it's not strong evidence. So this is currently being studied very closely. In general, however, we are not that lucky. We can't evaluate those endpoint functions quite as easily as that, and we have to really worry about this. And this thing is as a path integral is just terribly ill-defined. This is nowhere near being a Riemann integral. It's just totally ill-defined. Yeah?
The relation between entanglement and the non-vanishing two-point function. So let's say entanglement between two systems. Is it like if I have entanglement, the two-point function has to be non-vanishing and vice versa?
Yes. You can think of it as measuring a spin here and a spin there, but instead of, and you have some entangled state and then you have non-vanishing correlation function. It's similar to that, not quite the same.
But, and the problem is that.
That's right. That is right. Okay, so the key issue that we have now is this. We would like to evaluate the endpoint function, even though this thing here is just impossible to make sense of analytically. How can we do this? Now, there's a crucial trick, which goes back to Schwinger, Feynman, and a few others. And they said, let us try to massage this expression here in such a way that at the end, we can calculate this endpoint function without ever having to evaluate the path integral. There is a trick for doing this. It's very instructive that this is possible. Because it means it should be possible to pull off this whole quantum field theory business without that. Because we can actually calculate all the endpoint functions without ever really having to identify what the path integral means analytically. And that's what this talk is eventually aiming at. We can do an equivalent thing to this, more general than that, and well-defined, just on the basis of graph, not worrying about analyticity issues here. The idea is the following, of this trick by Schwinger and Feynman, is this. You see, this is a normalization factor here. And what is this normalization factor? Let me just remind you. The normalization factor is this. Okay, just the sum of all the probability amplitudes. Life would be very easy if this thing was just n as well, because then you would have n over n is 1, easy. Okay, it's not that easy. We have those three powers of the field in here. But if we can somehow manage to get rid of those three factors of phi in here, or n factors of phi in here, then we would have the path integral divided by the path integral, and no matter what it is, it would just cancel out. Okay? So can we do this? Can we pull this stuff in front of the path integral so that we're left with a path integral which is some constant, but we don't have to worry what it is because it cancels out with the normalization. This is what is actually going to work. The price we have to pay for that is that we then get a rather complicated mess of evaluating Feynman graphs. But that's how life is. Okay. So let me start with a concrete example here. Let's say we look at a single field, just one field instead of those dozens of fields that we have in nature. Just one field, let's call it phi. And let's look at an action that it might have. Also, just to make things a little bit better defined, let's assume that our function space is finite dimension. Of course, in principle, the function space of this field would have to be infinite dimension. But there is a procedure known as ultraviolet and infrared cutoff, which renders the function space finite dimensional. And then eventually we'd have to remove the cutoff and get an infinite dimensional function space back. But as long as we work with a finite dimensional function space, we can choose some ON basis in it, some orthonormal basis in it, and then the action is written instead of integrals in terms of sums. So the quadratic term is some matrix, and then phi is some discrete component vectors, and repeated indices are being summed over here. The interaction term, the next higher term in the polynomial that makes up the action, might be the third power term. And here we have the interaction potential, where in principle we would write V of x, x prime, and x double prime perhaps, but we've chosen some orthonormal basis in a finite dimensional function space, and in that basis, the field has components phi A, and then the potential also has component V, A, B, C. And we are summing over repeated indices. These prefactors, 1/2 and 1/3, 1/3 factorial, are just combinatorially convenient. Now comes a very useful trick that will carry us through this program that Schwinger and Feynman outlined. Namely, we define an auxiliary field J. So we define, this is the path integral here, with the sum over all the probability amplitudes for the fields. And we add to it this term I times phi j in the exponent. And then the path integral, since we are working with a finite dimensional function space now, becomes a finite number of ordinary integrations, the product of the d phi n, which is well defined. So we integrate m times over Rn. Actually, that should be an m. No, it isn't m, yeah. Okay. It's not essential. I just wanted to make this as well defined as we can do it. Finite dimensional function space, path integral becomes a product of ordinary integrations. And we introduced here this field, extra field J. The key here is the following. Why do we introduce this field J? The point is this, if we differentiate that expression z of j with respect to phi, we're getting this factor phi down here in the path integral, okay? If we differentiate three times, we get three factors of phi down here, which is, for example, what we need for the three-point correlation function. So the three-point correlation function can then be written as the third derivative of this, okay? But you see this? This is just a regular path integral. We don't have phi factors here now. And that's going to be allowing us to cancel this path integral at the end. But we'll see it explicitly. Also, what is usually not noticed in this context, but let me point it out, this is really a Fourier transform. Okay, if you look at it, this is just a multidimensional Fourier transform. So this z of j, also called the partition function, is nothing but the Fourier transform of the exponentiated classical action. And that will play an important role later on. So here we have the classical action And if only we are able to calculate Z of J, then we will actually know the solution to our quantum field theory. Roughly speaking, here we have the problem, the action, and here we have the solution, Z of J, and they're related by Fourier transform. This is usually thought of as the process of quantization. We start out with the classical action and we get the quantum solution. But the very fact that this is a Fourier transform is amazing, because it means, well, Fourier transforms are invertible. Might as well go back, okay? I will come back to this issue in a moment. Okay, so Z of J is the partition function defined with this J field, auxiliary J field here. We also take the logarithm of this formally again, because this is complex and therefore it's not straightforward to take the logarithm. And with this definition, we can now write our endpoint functions in the following way. Simply the nth derivative of Z of J, because we get n phi fields down by differentiating n times. And if we then set J equal to zero, we get rid of this term, so we are exactly getting our endpoint correlation function, right? So we differentiate n times with respect to J, that gives us n factors of phi down here, gives us the path integral, except there's this factor here that's disturbing. Just set J equal to zero, and it goes away. So the endpoint function is the nth derivative of Z evaluated at J equal to zero, divided by the normalization factor, normalization is just the Z of zero. That's why we introduced the logarithm of Z, because then we can simply write it as the derivative of W. And then the logarithm will give us suitable inverse power here. So we are now halfway to the calculation of those Feynman rules, so the derivation of those Feynman rules and Feynman graph. So we follow the strategy of Schwinger and Feynman, and we pull the fields in front of the path integral. So here we have the path integral with this action. And then instead of writing here this potential term up here in S, we differentiate three times with respect to phi. So Z of J can also be written as e to the power of, and then the third derivative with respect to J acting on that piece here. Right, you have to view this as a power series, and then you get all those differentiations, which will give us all those powers of phi, which when summed up, give us at least, naively, not worrying about analyticity issues, will give us just this term. Now here we are left with a quadratic integration. It's just the highest power here is 2 in phi. And that's the sort of integral that we should be able to evaluate. In fact, we can complete the squares to make this a completely quadratic thing, and then carry out a Gaussian integration. Again, analytically speaking, that's not well defined, because this is not a Gaussian. It has an I here, not a minus. But physicists usually don't worry too much about this, and do it anyway. So, but again, that's what this talk is going to be about. We want to have, to not to have to worry about this analytic issues. Everything should be defined, it should be well defined. Okay, so if we carry out this Gaussian integration here, then that's the answer. This just becomes the same thing here over again. And that path integral becomes this, which is no longer path integral. You see what this is? Exponentiation of this inverse matrix contracted with J, J, and then some constant. That's the remaining path integral. And the key thing is that this constant is going to drop out. This is in principle the remainder of the path integral, but it's no longer depending on J, so we don't worry about it. If you remember, this is the definition of the endpoint function. It's Z inverse times the nth derivative of Z. Now, if Z is proportional to a constant, it does not depend on J, then it, the constant occurs here and occurs 1 over here. So it just drops out. So the whole path integral has disappeared, just canceled out. What we have to evaluate is only this. You see, this looks a bit like a mess. And that's where the Feynman rules come in. We have reduced the problem of finding the endpoint correlation functions, and therefore if it's equal time, for example, the n-partite entanglement, and we have reduced it now to calculating this, z of j, where we have all those derivatives. This is a power series in matrices and these derivatives with respect to the j, acting on this, which is like a Gaussian. It's again, you can think of this as a power series in the q's and the j's. So here we have a power series in j, and here we have a power series in derivatives of j. In principle, you can just write it out in terms by terms, and just work it out what it is. It's a huge mess. And that's why one introduces a, a graphical mnemonic device. Namely, one defines an edge as this factor here, I times Q inverse. It has two indices, I and J, for the two ends of the edge. And then a three vertex, which is just I times V, indices ABC. The three indices ABC stand for the three valence points of the three vertex. And the J is introduced as a one valent vertex, which goes back to the fact that here you see the J plays the role of a vertex here. You see we have quadratic part in S, that's this. We have a third power in, a second power in phi that gives us the edge, you know, from I to J. Then we have a vertex in S, which is this, a three-point vertex. And then the J plays the role of a one vertex. It multiplies only one power of the field. So with those definitions now, one can convince oneself by just starting to write out what this is explicitly, that z of j is nothing but the generating functional of all Feynman graphs. These are the Feynman rules. And z of j is the generating functional of all Feynman graphs. So what you do is you write down all graphs made up of those edges and those three vertices and those one vertices. Just write them up, all of them, connected and disconnected. Tree graphs and with cycles or without cycles, with 100 cycles, with 1,000 cycles, and so on. Just write them all up. Each one of them occurs once in this, up to the combinatorial factors that arise because of the power series expression for the exponential function, all automatically taken care of. So z of j is a generating functional of all Feynman graphs. Which means what? It means that, remember, z of j, if we differentiate it n times with respect to j, we get the endpoint functions, the endpoint correlation function. On the other hand, now knowing that this is the generating function for Feynman graphs, we also know that if we differentiate n times with respect to j, we get the sum of all n point Feynman graphs. We get the sum of all graphs that have n endpoints. Because we are differentiating n times with respect to j, which gets rid of this one vertex. That makes it an endpoint. So what we found here is that the endpoint correlation function can be calculated by calculating z of j, which is the generating function of all Feynman graphs. At this point, we've overlooked the normalization prefactor. So let's look at w of j. If we differentiate w of j n times, we actually get the correlation functions normalized. Now, the relationship between two generating functionals that are defined in terms of the exponential or logarithm of another is very well known in combinatorics. It describes the connectivity properties of the element. So in this case here, z of j is the generating function of all Feynman graphs. W of j then is the generating functional of all connected Feynman graphs. This is intuitive, actually. Assume that W of j is a generating functional of only the connected graph. Imagine you exponentiate that. What do you get? You get a power series in the sums of all the connected graphs, of all the connected graphs. And that gives you all graphs, also the disconnected ones. And the exponential is just taking care of the right combinatorial prefactors. So W of J is a generating functional of all the connected Feynman graphs. And W of J is also the solution to the Feynman field theory. Its nth derivative gives us right away the endpoint correlation function. So this is ultimately what we want to calculate, W of J. And we now know how to do it. We just have to work with those Feynman rules, or if we have more fields, more terms in the action, and more complicated Feynman rules, but it always works this way. Mm-hmm. Okay. However, Feynman graphs, and that's important, come up not only in quantum theory, but also in the classical theory. The setup of quantum theory, just to review what you just said, the setup of quantum theory is this. We define a problem by writing down the action as a phi. So that defines our problem. This is our fields, S of phi. That specifies how they interact, what they do. And then we do a Fourier transform, otherwise known as the path integral. So we do the Fourier transform, we do the path integral, and that we declare to be, by definition, the quantum solution W of J. And there was a theorem, which we just proved right now, where it was a theorem which says that W of J can be calculated as the sum of all connected Feynman graphs. There's a G missing here. Okay, so the definition is Fourier transform of the action, of the exponentiated action, gives us the quantum solution, W of J, and W of J can be calculated as the sum of all connected graphs. The setup of classical theory is similar. We start out by defining a problem, S of phi, the action that describes, tells us what fields there are and how they interact. And then we do not a Fourier transform, but the Lyrondo transform. And that gives us the classical solution, which you may call T of J. And there's another theorem, theorem two, which says that T of J, the generating functional for the classical solution, can be calculated as the sum of all tree graphs only. Now that's a non-trivial theorem there. By the way, Lyrondo transform, let's just review this issue. Why is it that the Lyrondo transform gives us the classical solution? The Lyrondo transform of the action is given by the T of J, the Lyrondo transform is the action minus the new variable times the old variable, integrated over or summed over as the case may be, with ds by d phi equal to j. That's just the definition of the new variable in terms of the old variable in the Lyrondo transform. This equation is not only the definition of the new variable in terms of the old variable. This definition is also the equation of motion. It's a classical equation of motion for this action. Okay, classical equation of motion. And it implies, easy to show, generally in the Lyrondo transform, that phi, the variable, can be recovered by differentiating t now with respect to j. Now phi is what we are after. That's the classical solution for this action where j is some external driving force phi. Phi is what we are after, that's this. So in other words, if we have calculated, once we've calculated t of j, we obtain the classical solution simply by differentiation with respect to j. So the Lyrondo transform gives us a classical solution. Yes? I don't know.
I would not think so, but let's talk about it after the hour. Okay, so.
Question?
Yes?
What do you mean here by classical solution? Do you mean the expectation value of the field?
No, classically there's no expectation value. No, what we have is this is the action classically, S of phi, and then we also have an external driving force, J. And then, you see, if there's no driving force, there's no field. And we are interested in finding out what is phi given J.
Okay.
And then we can calculate it this way. Okay, so this is a non-trivial theorem, surprisingly non-trivial, and that's what we will revisit here, and that's what the key result I want to present here, a new proof for this. This outlines how we do it. But you may wonder, why on earth would we be interested in this thing? Nature is quantum, not classical. Why do this? Point is, this is very important even in quantum theory. Namely, consider W of J. Remember, W of J is the generating function of all connected graphs. It is the solution, okay? It is the solution of the quantum field theoretical problem. If we differentiate it n times, we obtain the endpoint correlation function. This is it. This is the solution we are after. Now, let's define by Legendre transform a new power series, gamma of phi, the so-called quantum effective action. By Legendre transform, right? Fourier transform would get us to the classical action, but Legendre transform gets us to the quantum effective action. Why do we call it quantum effective action? Well, if we view gamma of phi as an action and we treat it classically, we only sum up the tree graphs for the Feynman rules of that action that come from gamma, then we obtain the full quantum solution W of J. In other words, this is the action that we should have started with. And if we had only then treated it classically, just summing up the trees, we would actually get the quantum solution W of J. So basically, gamma of phi incorporates all the quantum effects in the action. Concretely, it means that we take gamma, the quantum effective action, the Legendre transform of this thing, we read off the new Feynman rules from it, and then we can write the solution of the quantum field theory as the sum of all connected graphs of the old Feynman rules, which is a messy thing, but it is also the sum of all tree graphs of the new Feynman rules, the new Feynman rules of the effective action. This is an important insight for quantum field theory, where this is crucial for the procedure of regularization and renormalization and spontaneous symmetry breaking, for example. So what is this effective action concretely? I mean, I was dealing with it just now as if I knew what the gamma of phi is. But the whole issue is that W of J, we don't know to start with. I mean, that's the problem. We want to calculate this thing. If we have it, then we can do the Legendre transform and get gamma of phi, but we don't have it to start with. So what can we say about gamma of phi? What is it really concretely before we even calculate it exactly? Remember, this is what we just had. The full solution to the quantum field theory is the sum of all connected graphs of the old Feynman rules, the original, the true Feynman rules. But it's also the sum of the tree graphs of the Feynman rules of that come with the quantum effective action. An important definition is in order here. So-called one-particle irreducible graphs are graphs that cannot be disconnected by cutting one edge. Okay, so think of a Feynman graph. And now do a test. Check whether you can cut it into two pieces by cutting just one edge. If you can, it's reducible. If you cannot, if there's no single line that you could cut and it would fall into two pieces, then it's called a one-particle irreducible graph. And here's an important observation. Any connected Feynman graph is uniquely a tree whose vertices are maximal one-particle reducible graph. You have arbitrary complicated connected graph. And you can always identify in it maximal one particle reducible pieces, subgraphs, which hang together in a tree-like fashion. From that one can conclude that the new Feynman rules of the effective action are just have just the one particle reducible graphs with n n's as their n vertices. So the n vertex of the quantum effective action is the sum of the one particle irreducible graph with n n's. It's just this decomposition that is achieved by going to the new action, to the quantum effective action. In other words, the quantum effective action is the sum, or more precisely, the generating functional of all one particle irreducible graphs. This has practical significance, and I'm mentioning this because our results generalize that. There's practical significance. The one-particle reducible graphs are building blocks for connected graphs. Any connected graph, as we just said, can be decomposed into one-particle reducible subgraphs. And then once you have calculated the one-particle reducible subgraphs, you can piece together the connected graph without further integration, because it's just a tree structure. There are no more loops, no more cycles in it. That's very important because calculating the cycles is a mess in quantum field theory. It's complicated. You have to regularize and renormalize. So you deal with the one-particle reducible graphs first, and then you can put together your connected graphs without further worry. No further integration is necessary. Okay, so now finally to the new result. Remember theorem two. What theorem two was saying is that T of J, which was defined as the Legendre transform of the action, or the Legendre transform of an effective action, I mean, just any generating function, really. T of J, the Legendre transform of the action, is the sum of all tree graphs. Remember what the context is. If you take the action and you do the path integral, which is to say you do an exponentiated Fourier transform, if you take the action, exponentiated and Fourier transform, then you get the full quantum field theoretical solution. You get W. You get the generating function of the connected graph. If, however, you take the action and you do the Legendre transform, then you don't get the sum of all connected graphs. Now you get only the sum of all trees. That's the classical analog, okay? So quantum is Fourier transform. Quantum is sum of all connected graphs. Classical is Legendre transform. Classical is summing only the tree graphs. So we proved theorem two again, the statement that the classical solution is obtained by summing only the tree graph, which, as I said, is important also because for the quantum effective action, you need that as well. Why would we prove this again? Well, we proved it again because in the literature, the existing proofs are not really all that nice. Either they use unnecessarily the so-called Bessel-Schwinger equations of motion, or they require tedious induction that is not very transparent, or they employ some limit taking, which shouldn't be necessary and isn't rigorous. The thing is that limit taking is very, well, it's questionable here because our power series are not convergent to start with. And then we take limits, that's not a safe thing to do. So the advantages of our proof are that it's purely combinatorial. We treat the power series that occur, such as gamma, such as W, all those power series in the field, we treat them as former power series, as elements of a ring. We don't have to make any assumptions about convergence of the power series. And that's good so, because in all reasonable theories, all realistic theories that we know of, those power series are not convergent. So this is a safe thing to do. So we make no analytic assumptions whatsoever, and our proof is relatively short and transparent. Here's the proof strategy. What we do is we reduce our theorem two. Theorem two is basically this statement, namely that the sum of the tree graphs is given by the Legendre transform in terms of the classical action. This is the Legendre transform. We reduce this statement, theorem two, classical problem solving means the Legendre transform. This statement, and we reduce it to the basic statement about the connectivity of tree graphs. You see, the theory of connectivity in math is homology. And the homology of graphs says that tree graphs have this Euler characteristic. One is the number of vertices minus the number of edges, which is also trivial to check. It's a simple, very simple case. So what we show is that this statement, the Legendre transform, the sum of all tree graphs is given by the Legendre transform of the action, is actually basically term by term this statement. That it is just the Euler characteristic is one. That's what it says. Every tree occurs on the left-hand side of the upper equation exactly once. That's the T, that's the one here. And on the right-hand side, every tree occurs V times, where V is the number of vertices on the right-hand side, and minus E times on the right-hand side, where E is the number of edges of the graph. So I think that's pretty neat, because it boils it down to the essence of it. It's just the essence of the connectivity of tree Feynman graphs is just this statement, and that's what the Legendre transform really means. And the nice thing is that this is purely combinatorial, whereas that is an analytic statement, which unfortunately is not very well defined. In fact, it's ill-defined in the case where this would be the quantum effective action, that would be W, ill-defined. Neither the quantum effective action nor W, the generating function of connected graph, can be assumed to be converted.
The case for genus zero.
Yes, exactly, yes, that's right.
And
a Gibbs generalization.
Okay, so now what are the ramifications of this? What we can do is we can now generalize this theorem too for general Euler characteristics, and just following up on your comment, where we would have that if G is the genus of the embedding, then we would have 2 minus 2G is the number of vertices minus the number of edges plus the number of faces of the graph. That's not just a game, but we can also generalize now the decomposition of graphs into n particle reducible subgraphs. Subgraphs in which you would have to, which don't decompose into 2 pieces, even if you cut n pieces. So that's a further decomposition of connected graphs into 1 particle reducible, 2 particle reducibles, and so on, which is of interest for practical calculation. But I think more significant actually is the fact that we can now generalize Legendre transform and Fourier transform for realistic cases of actions, of sums of tree graphs, sums of all graphs, sums of connected graphs, quantum effective actions. Namely, what we showed by reducing this to a mere combinatorial statement, the Euler characteristic is 1 for trees in this case. We showed that the Legendre transform makes sense and holds true even when the power series we start out with and end up with are just formal power series that don't have, that are not convergent. And so in particular, it means, well, we'll get to this. After all those power series are generally, cannot be assumed to be convergent except for the action, which might be convergent if it's really just a polynomial. But we don't know if it's really a polynomial, the action. So let me stress this. What we do here is we give a new definition of the Legendre transform. We also give a new definition of what is Fourier transform. A definition that has nothing to do with analysis, that has nothing to do with differentiation, for example, nothing to do with integration. Instead, what we say is, if you want to do a Legendre transform of such a power series, we say, look at the power series as an action. In order to calculate the Legendre transform, look at the power series, not as a function. Look at it as a formal action. Read off the Feynman rules. From the quadratic part, you get the edge. From the other powers, you get vertices. Read off the Feynman rules, and then sum up the sum of the tree graphs. And that defines the Legendre transform. It has nothing to do with the usual definition, except it reduces to it when the usual definition is well defined. In fact, the Legendre transform is an involution up to a trivial minus sign. If you do the Legendre transform twice, you get back to where you started. We can prove this involution property as well, combinatorially. You don't have to rely on analytic assumptions in this. And I'm only stressing this because in quantum field theory, the assumptions don't hold true, and analyticity assumptions. Similarly now, but there we are not as far yet, we can do the following. We can redefine what is Fourier transform, not worrying about integration at all. Instead, we say, take the function we want to Fourier transform, view it as e to the power of an action, read off from that action the Feynman rules, quadratic part gives you an edge, and then the other powers in the action give you vertices. Write down the sum of all connected graphs, which is an explicit constructive procedure to do. And the result you call the Fourier transform. We would conjecture that this Feynman graph theoretically defined Fourier transform is also involutive. The analytic Fourier transform, the usual Fourier transform, is an involution. If you do it twice, you get back to where you started from. We conjecture that it is also true in this more general setting where you don't have to make the analytic assumptions. But that still needs to be proven. Now, this means that we can now actually, assuming that it's not only the Legendre case that we covered fully, but also the Fourier case that we have not yet covered fully goes through purely algebraically, we can do the following. We can say that the algebraic Fourier transform and Legendre transforms of the usual theory, the analytic ones, can be replaced by the algebraic ones, by the graph theoretic ones. which means in particular that we can get rid of this ill-defined path integral. I mean, we can still write it down and do the usual thing, but we can do something that's much better defined. See, this is a path integral. It's not well defined. What does it mean? We integrate over all fields in the function space. This is nowhere near being convergent. It's not like a Brownian motion where we can make it relatively well defined. But instead, we can say that this analytically ill-defined Fourier transform, we can define a well-defined way simply in terms of the Feynman graphs. Take this thing, read off the Feynman rules, sum up the sum of the connected graphs, declare this to be the Feynman, the Fourier transform.
Perturbative contribution.
Well, that's right. That's right. This is perturbative contribution. There may be no perturbative effect, but I'm getting to this actually.
So you shouldn't expect that that strategy is you can do the other, you can go the other way around because it's not the case.
I assure you that actually they're touching upon a very interesting thing, because there's a duality coming up that is totally amazing, and I don't know whether what the significance of that is in terms of non-perturbative kind of thing. I don't know, but we'll see that it comes up in a minute. So. So what we see now here is that this path integral, analytically defined as it usually is, namely as a Fourier transform, is ill-defined. We want to do better than that. However, we want to keep something about it. Namely, remember that there was a deep principle in this. It was the principle of second quantization. It was the principle that the path integral here represents that classical evolution is the evolution according to the extremal action, whereas quantum evolution explores all possibilities with probability amplitudes. That's how we derive the path integral. So what happens to this principle? We want to keep something like this principle, that classical means extremal path, quantum means all paths with probabilities or probability amplitudes. In fact, when we move from this analytic definition of Fourier transform to the graph theoretic definition of Fourier transform, we can keep this. Only it's no longer the fields. You see, here we are saying that the classical field evolution is the one of extremal action, whereas the quantum field evolution is really all evolutions with probability amplitude. Here what we have is this. Classically, here what we have is that the evolution, the quantum evolution, is given by the sum of all graphs, okay? And the classical special case is where we sum only over the shortest paths. Now, graphs, theoretically, the shortest paths are the tree graphs. You don't do a circuitous route. You don't do cycles. You don't do loops, okay? So the shortest path, and that can be well defined, actually. There is a notion of length of a graph. And the shortest graph is always a tree. So the classical solution is the one of the shortest path, graph theoretically, which means the tree graph, which is exactly what theorem 2 says, namely that the classical solution is obtained by taking the tree graphs off, whereas the quantum solution is obtained by taking all the graphs, I mean all the connected graphs, including loops, cycles. So what that means is that a unified picture emerges for first and second quantization. Remember that in first quantization, we have that the for those of you who are familiar with it, the propagator in quantum mechanics, I'm just talking quantum mechanics, propagator is itself a path integral over all paths. The propagator is also the edge here. So what we have is when we say that the evolution, quantum evolution in quantum field theory, is the sum of all graphs, it is really the sum of all paths, where it is the sum of all paths that make up every individual edge, but then also we piece together all those edges with vertices to get those big graphs. So the first quantization statement that the edge, the propagator, is the sum of all paths gets generalized in quantum field theory to the sum of all graphs. Yes, I think I have only one more slide. So now we just come to a final observation there whose significance I don't really know yet. The De Donghi transform, as we already discussed, is involute. And that means that we have a very strange duality. We can define a problem by giving an action. So we say, this is our fields, this is how they interact, given by the act. Then we do a Lagrangian transform, that gives us the solution, T. Classic, right? So we're still thinking here with a classical thing. The classical solution is the Lagrangian transform. The problem is the action. But the Lagrangian transform is invertible, which means it's not only invertible. Invertible is usual, right? You start with a problem. If it has a unique solution, then you can work backwards from the solution toward the problem. But here we have more than that. The Lagrangian transform not only gets us to the solution, the Lagrangian transform applied again gets us back to the original problem. Which means that if we view the solution T, this generating function, as an action, then it defines a problem, okay, of which we can calculate the solution by doing the Lagrangian transform again, and the solution is back to the original problem. Which means that problem and solution are the same thing. So you start out with a problem. It's the Lagrangian transform is the classical solution. But that solution as a power series can be viewed as an action which defines a problem for us, which we can solve by the Lagrangian transform. And what is the solution of the solution? It's the original problem. Very strange. Also, that means in graphs, in terms of graphs, this has some very strange meaning. Namely, you see, it's rather non-trivial. The sum of the tree graphs is the sum of all trees that you can make from the Feynman rules of A. Since the Lagrangian transform is an evolution, the action is also the sum of the trees made from the Feynman rules of T. Okay? So T viewed as an action defines Feynman rules. And the sum of the trees of those Feynman rules gives us the action sum. So that means we start out with S, the action, the generating function of our Feynman rules. The Lagrangian transform gives us the generating function of trees. View it as an action. It defines Feynman rules. Look at the trees of those. These are the Feynman rules again. One would think that things get more complicated as you consider trees of trees. But what this involution property of the Lagrangian transform means that there must be subtle cancellation. The sum of the trees of the trees is the original Feynman rules again. Amazing. Which we can prove, and did prove combinatorially. So no assumption that it's strictly always true. And we would conjecture that the similar duality should exist also on the algebraic level for the Fourier transform. But that's not yet proved, which would mean that if you take Feynman rules, you do the Fourier transform, you get the sum of all connected graphs. The sum of all connected graphs, you can use an action, read off the Feynman rules, look at the sum of connected graphs of those, you get back to the original Feynman. Amazing. Why could the sum of the connected graphs of the sum of the connected graphs be the Feynman rules again? But that's what it is. You have a huge blowing up of graphs of graphs. And then it all collapses back to the original Feynman. It certainly does for the case for the Lagrangian transform. Analytically, since Fourier transform is an evolution, it should also be true there. So that's just the final comment here. The question is, how general is this duality phenomenon in graph theory, beyond Feynman graph, just in general in graph theory? Could it be that there's a more general feature that if you look at graphs of a particular kind, that you go back to the original building blocks of your graph? I don't know how general that is. And then in physics, what does it mean here that there's not only an invertible map between problem and solution, but the map that gets you from the problem to the solution is the same as the map that gets you from the solution to the problem. So if you view the solution as a problem, applied again, you get back to the problem. What does that mean, this duality between problem and solution in physics? I have no idea, but it looks interesting. Thank you.
I have two questions. The first, when you consider the generalized Euler characteristic, you have an F there. What would be the Feynman rule? Feynman rule counterpart for that F part.
Well, okay. In our case here, in the case of the tree, we would just have that the genus is zero, and then we would have that the number of faces is one for the tree. And then we would have that 2 is equal to V minus E plus 1. So 1 is equal to V minus E.
enough. But in Feynman rules, you have the Feynman rules for V. Also, you have Feynman rules for V. My question is, do you have Feynman rules corresponding to F?
Oh, that's, I think that would correspond to the number of cycles.
I see, okay. No direct Feynman rule.
No, no, it's not a Feynman rule. It has to do with the number of cycles.
Some question is about your combinatoric tool. You know, in many combinatoric tools, actually, you need to assume that things are finite. Otherwise, you know, that means some manipulations may not make sense for Feynman graphs with divergent integral. Actually, that's the essence of the regularization and the renormalization for the PPH thing. They need to subtract some subgraphs, okay, so that
yes, I see what you mean.
So then my question is, yeah, from your point of view, okay, what's the meaning of the BPSC subtraction of subgraphs?
I don't know, but I think you're touching upon a very important point. It's the reason why we don't have the proof for the Fourier case yet. You see, when we look at the Legendre case, then everything is locally finite. Everything is just finite operations or finite pieces of power series. And therefore, it's safe. But for the Fourier transform, it's not the case. The simple reason is this, that if you have, if you look at trees with n, there's only finitely many of them. If you look at connected graphs with n, there's infinitely many of them. And that's the difficulty why we can't do the Fourier case of the way.
You know, Cramer and also Alan Kuhn, they have some
that should be
which is a adopted form of the BPHC, forest formula.
Yes,
I remember hearing about that. I should look into it.
You didn't say the relationship between the JC and the non-perturbative theory that you mentioned.
Oh, right. Well, what we have seen here is that there is a discrete drive between problem and solution. But that's a statement about perturbative quantum field theory. And it would be, the big question is there such a duality for quantum field theory per se in a non-perturbative state? And I don't know that. See, it's a deeply perturbative statement to say that if we take an action, read off the final rules, write up the sum of all connected graphs, then we get another power series. And then if we do the same thing to the power series, we get back to the original action. That's a perturbative thing to do. And the question is there such a duality of applying I don't even know how to define that in a particular way. Is there a method or a map that, maybe that's it. If you take the quantum field theoretical problem and you look at the abstract map into its solution, is that an involution?
Here, a comment. Quantum field theories are called the topological quantum field theory, in which we think all correlation functions actually are finite. And the perturbation theory actually can be applied to such theory. And the belief is that the perturbation theory should reproduce, in the power series form of the finite one. So maybe you conjecture.
Or could
be
checked.
First, tested perturbation theory.
That's a good point.
Theory.
Okay, so we have two quick questions. One is Rafael and one is Jens, and they require two quick answers.
Oh, that's very stupid, then, and very quick. Concerning the duality of the Legendre transform, so the conjugate function, which is the same thing of the conjugate, is just the same function if the part of the function is convex. So what's the convex function here?
That's the amazing thing. Analytically, you're totally right. The Legendre transform is really only defined if the amplitude of a function is one-to-one correspondence to its slope. which is to say that it has to be a convex function. That's an analytic requirement from the Euler transform. Now, when we prove that theorem 2 for with the Euler transform, and when we prove the involution property for the Euler transform, these are two proofs. We never ever needed them. We can do it without, which is a strange thing. So we can do the Euler transform for functions for which analytically there is no Euler transform. And we can show that it's involute. Very strange.
So in the usual description of perturbation theory, and also in the way you described it, you had a polynomial in the exponent. But the quadratic piece plays a special role.
That's right.
So that might be related to this perturbative aspect. Is it playing a special role throughout your whole discussion?
I'm wondering about that too. You're right. In principle, the action is some polynomial or power series in the field. And in practice, what one does is one singles out the quadratic term, keeps that in the partial group for the moment, and then takes all the other powers in front by using those differentiations with respect to J. Okay? And then deals with the quadratic part, saying this is a Gaussian integral, which I can and then we arrive at the final rules, where we have the quadratic part turns into the edge, and all the other parts become vertices. But it seems somewhat arbitrary that we would do the separation of the quadratic part. Why do we treat it separately? And I don't know. I suppose it's because the quadratic part of the propagator arose also in first quantization. It may just be a historic thing. I don't know whether one can go beyond that and treat all powers equally.
I mean, practically, it's because we can do Gaussian integrals.
Yes.
We can't do others, but you seem to be going beyond that to a sort of combinatorial image.
I'd love to do that. But I suppose then it couldn't be graphs anymore, because your edges would somehow be vertices as well. And
hypergraphs.
Yeah. Let me know if it works out.